These and other speculations swiftly carried me close to a dangerous ecstasy in which Vaucasson's erotic apparatus never occurred to me as a possible cause. My colleagues, of course, saw everything. "Armand, Armand, you have ruined a notable career, made enemies in the highest places. Can no longer work in this town even as a subscullion. Voila, and yet he sits, lapsed in this strange supernaturalism. Paris is no longer for you, my friend. You belong somewhere else. In China. In Pennsylvania. Everyone at least knows of China. But imagine, till then, I had never heard of Pennsylvania. They meant, as it turned out, a place in America where religious eccentricity of all kinds was not only tolerated but publicly indulged, where Schwenkenfelders might pass Unitarians' brush and Wesleyites scarce from Quakers raise a blush, as great Tox has it. The miraculous lay upon every hand. In the days that followed, I was much entertained with tales of fertile lands, savage women, giant vegetables, forests without end, marshlands seething with shellfish, buffalo herds the size of Paris. Increasingly, I wondered if somewhere in that American wilderness there might be a path, not yet discovered, to lead me out of my perplexity and into a place of safety from what was by now a long list of persecutors, unhappily including the duck, whose affection had grown multiplex with daily difficulties. At a time when I needed any work I could get, she resented even the few hours that might take me elsewhere to create some vulgarian's luncheon, in which the cost of any mistake would be fatally high. She grew jealous, imagining that I was seeking the company of some other duck. We mate for life. Alas, my poor Armand. As you yourself have pointed out, there's but one other in the world. Aha, my virgin double, somewhere upon a shelf in one of Vaucanson's many clandestine workshops. Oh, yes, and by the way, what progress have you made upon that simple errand? Wait, let me guess. Another barrier arisen? Another note gone astray? Or is it something more sinister, such as your desire to have the other for yourself, eh? Look, he sweats. He trembles. Admit it, betrayer. My social life had fallen to pieces. I could no longer show my face down at the soupçon. The duck was my shadow night and day. She started waking me up to criticize some item of my attire from days before, my choice of company, and at last, unacceptably, my cooking. 3 in the morning, and we sat bickering about my beet quiche. Beneath it, her iron confidence in the power conferred by her inedibility, being artificial and deathless, as I was meat and of the earth, my only hope was that her morphosis would somehow carry her quite beyond me, and soon. Meanwhile, Paris having grown impossible, I resolved secretly to leave for America. Feeling like a young man in a fable, who has used up all but one wish, I sent out my last note, held my breath, and was lucky. Upon the basis of a chilled brain mousse invented to celebrate the peace of Aix-la-Chapelle, I was able to secure passage to Martinique, and thence, through months of transshipment in everything from pirogue to pirate ship, at last to Newcastle upon Delaware, where I stepped ashore in the moonless dark. As it was said that the people there did not interfere with these nocturnal landings, being ever in dread of the French and Spanish privateers. Here, then, you wretched little frog. The company groans. It is Mr. Dimdown, hanger in hand. The Frenchman picks up his ashoir and raises one eyebrow. Chapter 38. 'Tis determined afterward that Mr. Dimdown, heretofore unacquainted with any confinement longer than hiding in the root cellar till the sheriff took his leave, had been drinking steadily whatever spirits came to hand for the 3 days previous, attempting, as he explains, to get the time to pass differently, that's all. Mr. Knockwood comes from around the bar, whilst Mrs. Knockwood, sorting her keys, heads for the musketoon in the china cabinet. And furthermore, Mr. Dimdown, in a fury, how dare you fabulating little swine pretend to any knowledge of America, having sneaked onto our shores upon your miserable belly, and so on. There, there now, gentlemen. The landlord slowing his address as much as he can afford to, whilst keeping an eye upon his wife's progress with the powder horns, funnel, and shot. Mr. Dimdown, mind my chef now. I can't afford to lose him. And you, Frenchy. Filthy frog. Dit adieu. Mr. Dimdown makes a murderous lunge with his blade, straight at the chef's unprotected heart. Immediately, inches short of its target, the weapon, from no cause visible to anyone, leaves Dimdown's grasp and sails across the room in a slow, some might say insolent arc, directly in among the blazing logs of the hearth, where none may reach. "'Twas magnetism or something," protests Mr. Dimdown, "and withal I stumbled, or was deliberately tripped up. Look ye, how am I to retrieve my bleeder now? The heat will ruin the steel. Damn you, monsieur!" Thus intones the Frenchman, with a twirl of his toque, the very duck in action. You have seen for yourselves. You have borne witness. Her capacity for flight having increased to ever longer distances in the years between then and now, till one day not even the vast ocean might deter her. Voila! I wake to find her perched at the end of the bed, quacking merrily as a milkmaid. Yes, she has followed me even to the new world, whether in affection or hatred, who can say? That 'tis passion none may dispute. And once again I am besieged as she continues upon her strange orbit of escape from the known world, whilst growing more powerful within it. To Louisa, this is beginning to sound like Peter Redzinger all over again. Upon an impulse, nevertheless, she places a somewhat larger-than-Parisian hand, a calloused working hand, cut and healed in a thousand places, sun-brown, hair-tucking, needle-nimble, upon his arm. A close observer, did one attend, might see him begin to flicker round the edges. Oh, monsieur, an angel, so? Perhaps, madame, it is merely the price I must pay for having left France. Yet, to be honest, coming from a place where people starve to death every night, if I must suffer the duck's inscrutable attendance in exchange for this miracle of plenty, then 'tis a bargain. On market days in Newcastle or Philadelphia, my heart yet soars as ever it has done, like a dream. Have you ever wanted to cook everything? The tomatoes, terrapins, peaches, rockfish, crabs, Indian corn, venison, bear, beaver, to create the beaver bourguignon. Who knows, perhaps even the beaver soufflé, non? He is gesturing excitedly. Sure, the Indians know how to cook beaver, she tells him. There's some glands you have to take out, and much fat to trim. But when 'tis done, right? Ach, as good as anything from a German kitchen, plain or fancy. You have actually, he gazes at her, that is, eaten? In the days they are to remain snowbound, a triangle will develop among the incorruptible pietist, the exiled chef, and the infatuated duck. Strangely, given her great powers for mischief, the duck does nothing to harm Louisa, indeed extends to her the same invisible protection, as if sensing a chance to observe love at first hand invisibly. Thus do Armand and Louisa, never knowing when she may be there watching, find one more obstacle in the way of bodily desires. She's being quite sympathetic about all this, don't you think? I don't know, Armand. Are you sure you've told me everything? My dearest, how could you even... She seems to know you so well. It does not, however, in fact, take long for the duck to grow far less certain than before that she even wishes an erotic life. Meanwhile, in their nivial confinement, the behavior of the company grows ever less predictable. And over my head, relates Squire Halligast, it formed an eclipse, an emptiness in the sky, with a cloud-shaped line drawn all about it, wherein words might appear, and it read, No king. Thank you for sharing that with us, sir, snarls the dependably viperous Mr. Whitpot, the first upon whom the squire's oracular charm has begun to lose its grasp. As days of snow and snow clouds and dark, unpromising shades of blue pass one into another, the readiness of immoderate sentiment to burst forth upon any or no occasion is felt by all to be heightening dangerously. Even young Cherry Coke struggles with it. Rosy Fizz a glimmer, seated at a table of local Dutch manufacture, writing in his memorandum book, as the snow lapses in wet silence across the rhombic panes before him, whilst from his pen, in bright, increasingly bloody tropes, speculation upon the Eucharistic sacrament and the practice of cannibalism comes a spurting. It had begun in scholarly innocence as a commentary upon an earlier essay by Brooke Taylor, the series and theorem eponym, on the lawfulness of eating blood. Mr. Knockwood observes from an upstairs window a depth of snow nearly level with its sill, and worrying about the supply of air in the room below, rushes to find and ask the astronomers. And what has happened to the light? Are there snow eclipses? Down in the pantry, Armand and Louisa are embracing, outdoing the sparkishness of even Philadelphian youth. Yet again, perhaps that is only what people bring out upon days when gossip is scarce, honoring the rest of the time their manifest innocence. Whilst Mitzi, out in this taupe daylight, is hanging about the stable hands and scullery boys, swinging her hair, flashing her eyes, getting into conversations that she then tries to prolong to some point she can't clearly enough define to herself. She's grown up with murderous Indians in the woods all round, painted bearskins and sharpened blades. She has a different sense of danger than do these mild estuarial souls, with their diet of fish like a race of house cats, so. Yet what she really wishes to prolong may be the state of never knowing exactly how safe she may be among the English fisher boys, as at first, at each new fall of snow, she has thrilled, knowing it means at least one more day of isolation with the inn's resident Adonises, or as Armand, feeling increasingly paterfamilial, prefers, slack-jawed louts. Lately, however, the winter has begun to oppress more than encourage her hopes. She actually starts looking about for chores to do, offering Armand her help in the kitchen, still a blush every time they speak, Louisa, as he is joyous to learn, having taught her at least the fundamentals. Soon he is allowing her to prepare salads and confiding minor arcana of French haute cuisine, its historical beginnings among the arts of the poisoner, its need to be carried on in an attitude of unwavering contempt for any who would actually chew, swallow, and attempt to digest it, and come back for more. The first 1,000 pot lid settings, from Le Gastreau's famed article in the Encyclopédie, the pot lid being indeed a particular hobby horse of Armand's, upon its proper arrangement often hanging the difference between success and failure. Off, on, all the way on, partly off, crescents of varying shape, each with its appropriate use. You must learn to think of the pot, as you look down upon it, as a sort of moon with phases, though keeping in mind Voltaire's remark about gas and astronomers. The Reverend looks on with interest. The Frenchman fascinates him. With his recent animadversions upon the Lord's Supper, he is attending more to food and its preparation. I thought I had put behind me, he writes, the questions of whether the body and blood of Christ are consubstantiated with, or transubstantiated from, the bread and wine of the Eucharist. Preferring at last to believe, with doctors such as Haimo of Halberstadt, that the outward forms are given to bread and wine as an act of God's mercy. For otherwise, we should be repelled by the sight of real human flesh and blood, not to mention the prospect of eating it. Thus to God's attributes must be added the skills of a master chef in so disguising a terrible reality. The question I cannot resolve is whether real flesh and real blood are themselves in turn further symbolic, either of some mystical body of Christ, in which participants in the Lord's Supper all somehow, mystically to be sure, become one, or of a terrible opposite, some alternate carnality, some way of finally belonging to the doomed world that cannot be undone. A condition, I now confess, I once roamed the earth believing myself to be seeking, all but asphyxiated in a darkling innocence which later generations may no longer fully imagine. But since those days of young hopes, illusory daybreaks, and the uncanny sureness of nerve, I have been down into other quarters of the city of earth, seen and smelled at village markets, hung amid the flies and street dust with the other animal meat, human flesh, offered for sale. In America, some Indians believe that the eating of flesh, and particularly drinking the blood of those one has defeated in battle, will transfer the virtues, as theologians might call them, from one's late opponent to oneself. A mystical union between the antagonists, which no one I have consulted is quite able to explain to me. it raises the possibility that savages who appear to be enemies are in fact connected somehow, profoundly, as in a covenant of blood, with war for them being thus a species of sacrament. This being so, as a practical matter out here, the warrior paths must be deemed holy and transgression of them serious to a degree difficult to imagine in the common British footpath dispute. We must either change our notions of the sacred or come to term with these nations, and sooner rather than later. Late one day, after his assault upon Armand, Mr. Dimdown answers a knock at the door of his room to find Mitzi Redzinger holding out his hanger cautiously by its strap. "I cleaned it up as best I could," she murmurs, gazing at anything but him. "A bit of soot, nothing worse, and I sharpened it for you." "You what?" "Armand has taught me how." She has stepped into the room and shut the door behind her, and now stands observing him, surprised at how tattered seems his foppery in the daytime. "No one sharpens this but me. This is genuine Damascus steel, for heaven's sake. Here, then, let us see the damage." Taking what seems far too long, he peers up and down the newly glittering edge and is soon making ornamental lunges and passes in the air, presenting each leg a number of times for her consideration, adjusting his cuffs and stock unceasingly. Appears that you may understand something about blades. A complicated assault upon a candlestick. Feels a little slow, used to be faster. Is there a fruitful lawsuit here? Yes, perhaps I shall take Knockwood to court, if spring ever comes. Say, Fraulein, your cap, what do you think you're doing? The goose, she is untying her cap, then taking it slowly off, unbinding and shaking out her hair. She is making it ripple for him. She is getting it to catch the winter light through the window. She is so flabbergasting this macaroni with it that he seems to fall into a contemplative daze before the deep undulations. A dreamer at the edge of the sea. Outdoors, the snow is upon the glide yet again, and soon 'twill be night. She remembers all the leagues of snow-covered terrain between here and the Redzinger farm, all going dark, the city she cannot quite believe in that lies ahead, her father's wretched departure, her mother's visible change, and lastly her own, which she can as little command as explain. Rests, hips, fluxes, odd swoons, a sharpening eye for lapses of character in young men. The Lord provides, her mother has told her. Wisdom comes to us, even as it appears to leave men. You won't need to go all the way to Philadelphia. Not much further than the town upon market day, so? He has begun apologizing for his assault upon the Frenchman. 'Twas vile of me. I know you are his friend. I wish there were some way. Simply tell him. Isn't it done among you? Go into that kitchen. You've seen his battery, the knives, the cleavers. Mrs. Dimdown raised no idiots, Fraulein. Oh, if you knew Armand, she laughs merrily. I am become a target for his instruments, edged and pointed. There our relation appears at a standstill. But recall that no one here has ever seen Armand cut anything. That's why he's teaching me how to, so that I can do what he can no longer bear. Perhaps it is my mother's doing. He has forsworn violence in the kitchen, not only toward meat, but the vegetables as well, for as little now can he bring himself to chop an onion as to slice a turnip or even scrub a mushroom. Perhaps you oughtn't to be telling me. A man needs his reputation. But as a veteran bladesman, you would never take advantage of him, I'm sure. His face grows pink and swollen, a sign she knows. She has been blurted at by young men. Feeling behind her for the doorknob, she is surprised to find herself several steps from it, well within the room. Mr. Dimdown, I trust you are well. Philip, he mumbles, actually, putting his hanger back in its scabbard. As you have confided in me, so may I admit to you that I have never, well, that is not yet, been obliged to, in fact... Oh, I can see you've never been in a duel. She pushes aside some hair that may be screening the full effect of the sparkle in her eyes. Ruin. Ah, you must despise me. She shrugs, abruptly enough to allow him to read it, if he wishes, as a sympathetic shiver. We have had enough of fighting out where we live. It is not to me the novel thrill that some Philadelphia girl might think it. Taking up the hair that has fallen forward over her right shoulder, she shifts the locks back and slowly leftward, tossing her head from time to time. Ignoring this opening, all a fidget, "Are you the only one that can see it, or does everyone know that I've never been out, as if engraved upon my head or something?" "Calm, Philip. I'll tell no one." In lurches the landlord. "Your mother's looking for you, miss," flourishing his eyebrows at them both. "Trouble," mutters young Dimdown. He wishes to apologize to Monsieur Allegre. Mitzi quickly sings out, "Isn't that it, sir?"
"That is."
"Excellent, I can arrange that," and Mr. Knockwood dashes off again. "I'm putting my life in your hands here," says Philip Dimdown. "No one else is what they seem. Why should you be?" 'Tis only now that Mitzi, at last, finds herself a blush, this being her very first compliment, and a roguish one at that. He seems at once considerably wiser, if no older. And presently, in the afternoon lull between meals, the peace is made, the two men shaking hands at the kitchen door and commencing to chatter away like two daws upon a rooftop. Louisa comes by with a trayful of Dutch kisses, provoking witty requests, most of which, though not all, she avoids gracefully. "Damn me for a bun brain, monsieur, as if I'd actually impale the greatest cook in the colonies. But your movement with the blade, so elegant, so professional." "Not exactly the great fig, I regret to say. Indeed, never closer to the real thing than private lessons at an establishment in New York from a Professor Tissonnier. But I knew him in France. He once commented upon my braised pork liver with aubergine, offered to teach me the St. George Parry if I'd give him the receipt. He was esteemed for that, indeed, and for his hanging guard. I'd show it to you, but I wouldn't want to nick up the old spadroon. Damascus steel, is it not? Fascinating. How was that moire effect done?" "By twisting together two different sorts of steel, or so I am told, then welding the whole. A time-honored technique in pastry as well. The armorers of the Japanese islands are said to have a way of working carbon dust into the steel of their swords, not much different from how one must work the butter into the croissant dough. Spread, fold, beat flat, spread again and again, till one has created hundreds of these prodigiously thin layers." "Gold beating as well, now you come to it," puts in Mr. Knockwood. "'Tis flatten and fold, isn't it, and flatten again among the thicknesses of hide, till presently you've these very thin sheets of gold leaf." "Lamination," Mason observes. "Lo, lamination abounding," contributes Squire Halligast, momentarily visible. "Its purpose is how dark. Yet have we ever sought to produce these thin sheets innumerable, to spread a given volume as close to pure surface as possible, whilst en route discovering various new forms, the laden pile, decks of playing cards, contrivances which, like the lever or pulley, quite multiply the apparent forces, often into disproportionate results." "The printed book," suggests the Reverend. "Thin layers of patterned ink alternating with other thin layers of compressed paper, stacked often by the hundreds. Or an unbound heap of broadsides," adds Mr. Dimdown, "dispersed one by one and multiplying their effect as they go." The macaroni is, of course, not what he seems, as which of us is. The truth comes out weeks later when he is discovered running a clandestine printing press in a cellar in Elkton. He looks up from the fragrant sheets, so new that one might yet smell the apprentice's urine in which the ink swabs were left to soften, bearing to sensitized nasalia sub-messages of youth and longing, all about him the word repeated in large type, liberty. One civilian leads in a small band of soldiers. "Last time you'll be seeing that word." "Don't bet your wife's reputation on it," the quarrelsome fop might have replied. Philip Dimdown, returned to himself, keeps his silence. If we choose to take the romantic approach, "We must," appeals Tenebrae. "Of course he was thinking about her. How did they part?" Honorably, "He kept up the fop disguise till the end." "Impossible, uncle. He must have let her see, somehow, at the last moment, so that then she might cry, bid him farewell, and the rest." "The rest?" Ives, alarmed. "After she meets someone else."
"Ah," groans Ethelmer.
"Never ends," adds Cousin Depew. Chapter 39, the last chapter in Part 1. All right, then, if thou really want to know what I think. Of course. The surveyors have been at this since noon. Squire Halligast predicts an end to the general incarceration by tomorrow. Everyone not yet reeled away into madness prays that it be so, for no one here can bear much more company. Without meaning offense, then, 'tis against nature. What, to mourn my wife? Not to be seeking another. For a moment, Mason inspects his coadjutor's shins, then his eyes shift away and grow unfocused. Were we in Gloucester, I should expect, naturally, to hear such useful advice as this. 'Tis the expected thing. Simple country procedure. Alas, I may have stopped in London for too long, breathing its mephitic airs, abiding too close to its evil, unsleeping. I know I have been corrupted, but perhaps it has unmanned me as well. You're just not getting out enough. Out? Out where? Gesturing at the window, white mineral desolation, unvarying and chill. Out of your melancholy. Try as he may, Mason can detect in this naught but kind intent. I only hope you're not suggesting anyone in our immediate company. I mean, you haven't been. That is, what am I saying? Of course you've... His eyes happening to fall upon Dixon's stomach, whose size and curvature seemed different to him. Somehow, the figure of it indeed changing one day to the next, the rest of us watching in some alarm its transition from a spheroid vertically disposed to one more wide than high. Ah, 'tis someone in the kitchen, am I right? Either that or I'm pregnant, holding his corporation and gazing down at it. If so, 'twould be by Maureen, for I've been true to no other, she being the one you'll recall who bakes. The pies, Mason is joyous to enumerate. The tarts, the jam-stuffed doughnuts, the lengthy menu of French crèmes and mousses, the fruitcake soaked in brandy, be it feast day or no. Stop, cries Dixon, thou'r making me hungry. Arr, warns Mason. Sure, you wouldn't like to just pop back to the bakehouse, take a chance that she's in, find one or two of those iced waffles, aye, she or her friend Peggy, happen you've seen her, the redhead with the curls, wears green all the time. There it is, dammy, you persist, whenever I begin to imagine we're past this. One or two malicious jokes, that's fine, I'm a good sport, but pray you, grant me a respite, no Peggy's. Perhaps I'm only trying to get thee to eat something. This self-denying has its limits. Thou'rt down to skin and bones with it. 'Tis an affliction sentimental, in which melancholy hath depressed thy appetite for any pleasure. Hold! You're sitting there like Henry VIII, advising me upon dietary matters? Regard yourself, sir. How are we to do accurate work in the field, with you subtending so many degrees of it, even at the horizon? What is this spheroid you bear? Tapping Dixon's belly, or rather lug about like some Atlas who doesn't plan to bring the globe all that far. 'Tis prolate still, with a long dejected Geordie O, isn't it? I'm an astronomer. Trust me, 'tis gone well to oblate. Thanks for your concern at the altitude of my spirits, but what you're really seeking is an accomplice in the pursuit of your own various fitful vices. So, by the time the snow abates enough to allow them to rejoin the Harlands, the surveyors, having decided thereafter to journey separately, one north and one south, to see the country, return to the Harlands the use of their honeymoon quilt, and kindly allow John Harland to toss one of his new silver shilling pieces, which lands heads, sending Mason north and Dixon south. Next time, they agree to reverse the directions. Happen I'll find some place warm at last. Dixon, a bit too cheerfully. See here, I hope we'll go ahead with it. I mean, it's been like a boothload of puppets swinging clubs all about, hasn't it? I know, I'm as unquiet as thee. Why, aye, we must spread out. The one thing we know of this place is that dimension abounds. Dixon was first to leave, the Reverend relates, and with no indication in the field book of where he went or stopped, let us assume that he went first to Annapolis. How assume, objects Ives. There are no documents, Wicks. Perhaps he stayed on at Harlan's and drove all of them south, with his drunken intriguing after every eligible, meaning every milkmaid in the forks of Brandywine. Or let us postulate two Dixons, then, one in an unmoving stupor throughout, the other, for simplicity, assumed to have ridden, as Mason would the next year, out to Nelson's Ferry over Susquehanna, and after crossing, perhaps, though not necessarily, on to York, taking then the Baltimore Road south, instead of the one to Frederick, as Mason would, south to Baltimore and through it, ever southing, toward Annapolis and Virginia beyond. Though with suspicions as to his Calvert connections already high, Dixon might have avoided Maryland altogether instead of tempting fate. He comes into Annapolis by way of the rolling roads, intended less for the public than for the hogsheads of tobacco being rolled into market from distant plantations night and day with two or three men to each hogshead. African slaves, Irish transportees, German redemptioners, and such, who understand well enough that others might also prefer to travel this way. In town, Dixon roams unfocused from wagoners' taverns to harbor-front sailors' dens. "Only looking for that card game," he replies if asked, and if they say, "What card game?" he beams ever so sorry and retreats from the area, feigning confusion about everything save the way out. For one tavern is as likely as another to provide opportunities for mischief. He has certainly, and more than once, too, dreamt himself upon a dark mission whose details he can never quite remember, feeling in the grip of forces no one will tell him of, serving interests invisible. He wakes more indignant than afraid. Hasn't he been doing what he contracted to do, nothing more? Yet, happen this is exactly what they wanted, and his sin is not to have refused the work from the outset. When they later reconvene at Harlan's, Mason gets around to inquiring of Dixon what was his purpose in entering Maryland. Bait? Make myself available? Like friend Franklin out in the thunder gusts? You wish to be stricken, assaulted? I'm content with approached. Yet no French agents nor Jesuits in disguise have announced themselves, nor have Freemasons cryptically signed to me. Yet I suppose my own surveiller might be secreted anywhere in our party, among our axemen, cooks, or followers, noting everything. In Williamsburg, at last, Dixon feels he has come to the heart of the storm. There can be no profit in going any further south. This will have to do for whatever he may learn. The tobacco plantations lie inert, all last season's crop being well transported to Glasgow by now, and the seeds of the next not yet in flats. Whilst the young, who seem to be at every hand, take their joy of assemblies and river parties, balls and weddings, others, longer in the curing shed, rather hasten to explore at last the seasonless vales of sleep with trusted, how else, African slaves to stand in cordons all around and keep each dreamer safe. Dixon rides into town, a maze-like disposition of split-rail fences, a dockyard's worth of shiplap siding, a quiet profligacy of Flemish bond to be found upon vertical surfaces from pig ark to palace. The last seed pods hang, black and unbreached, from the catalpa trees. Swains by garden walls rehearse the arts of misunderstanding. Some nights, the wind, at a good canter, will as easily freeze tears to uncreased faces as fingertips to waistcoat buttons. There is an edge to young romance this year that none of those testing its sharpness may recognize, quite yet. The Stamp Act has reassigned the roles of the comedy, and the audience are in an uproar. Suddenly, fathers of desirable girls are no longer minor inconveniences, some indeed proving to be active foes capable of great mischief. Lads who imagined themselves inflexible rivals for life find themselves now all but comrades in arms. The languorous pleasantries of love are more and more interrupted by the brisk requisitions of honor. Over the winter solid roads goes a great seething of mounted younger gentlemen riding together by the dozens upon rented horses, express messengers in love with pure velocity, disgruntled suitors with pistols stuffed in their spatterdashes, sealed wagons not even a Western black boy would think of detaining. The May session of the Burgesses, the eloquent defiance of Mr. Patrick Henry and the Virginia resolutions, that dividing ridge beyond which all the streams of American time must fall unmappable, lie but weeks ahead. At the college, Dixon may hear wise prophecy, at the State House, interested oratory, but there proves no place quite as congenial to the unmediated newness of history a-transpiring as Raleigh's Tavern. Virginians, young and old, are standing to toast the king's confoundment. When it's his own turn to, Dixon chooses rather to honor what has ever imported to him, raising his ale can to the pursuit of happiness. "Hey, sir, that is excellent," exclaims a tall, red-headed youth at the next table. "And ain't it oh so true? You don't mind if I use the phrase sometime?" "Pray thee, sir." Has someone a pencil? The youth finds a scrap of paper, and Dixon lends him his lead vine that he uses for sketching in the field. "Surveyor? Say," it occurs to him, scribbling, "are you Mason or Dixon?" "Tom takes a relative interest in West Lines," quips the landlord, his father having helped run the one that forms our own southern border. Upon the topic of West Lines, Dixon assures him, any advice would be more than welcome, anything. 'Twas Colonel Byrd that began it. Paul, with Professor Fry, continued it. My guess is the professor did most of the mathematical work, for I know Paul was ever impatient with that. He would wear out books of tables, so vehemently did he consult them. Colonel Byrd's segment is the oldest, run long before my time. He recorded each day in a field book, not only the miles and poles traversed, but more usefully all the human stuff, the petty resentments, the insults offered and taken, the illnesses, the cures, the food they ate, the spirits they drank, the ladies of all hues who captured their various eyes now and again. Is it printed and sold? Not yet. When it shall be, I hope that every surveyor will read it as a term of his apprenticeship. My father styled it one of the great cautionary tales of the vocation. As to joint ventures, particularly when half the commissioners live north of the other half. In Colonel Byrd's history, the Carolinians in the party were envious, gluttonous, slothful degenerates all, somehow owing to the difference in latitude. 'Twould not surprise me if Pennsylvanians were to entertain similar opinions of their own neighbors to the south, including Virginia, this land of sensual beasts. Three young ladies are peeping round the doorway like shorebirds at the edge of the water, stepping nicely in and out of that aura of tobacco smoke that men for centuries have understood keeps women away as well as they were bugs. "I'm going in," declares the boldest of the girls, actually then proceeding two or three steps inside before crying, "Ew!" and skipping in retreat. Then another would try, "And ew!" and out again, and so forth, amid an unbroken stream of close discussion, their desire for romantic mischief thus struggling with their feminine abhorrence of tobacco. Dixon beams and waves at them. Are all Virginian ladies as merrily disposed? Everywhere but at Norfolk, where talk of passion far outweighs its enactment. Indeed, the sailor's paronomasia for that wretched place is no fuck. They'll be wishing to dance, I think, judges young Tom. We've been hearing that music for a while now. But watch your form, sir, if dueling not be your preferred pastime. For one wrong dance step, leg before wicket, as you might say, and no shortage of Virginia blades about to defend a lady's honor, 'twill be out at dawn with you. Sure enough, no more than 20 steps into the assembly room, and 8 measures into a lively jig with a certain Urania, Dixon is aware of a perfumed flickering upon one cheek, which proves to be the glove of her fiancé, Fabian. Did they tell you I was a Quaker, sir, and would not fight? They did, which is why I suggest we settle this at quoits, sir. Megs at 40 feet, ringers only. Hey, most agreeable, says Dixon, instead of, as he will insist he meant to say, if so, they are quizzing with you, sir. In fact, I am a transported felon of the most desperate stripe, to whom, in the great feast of sin, murder is but an hors d'oeuvre. We have found quoiting, Fabian is explaining, similar enough to pistols to satisfy us, with the same long and narrow field, the rencontre, if one wishes at dawn, the 2 megs driven in the ground at a distance negotiable, the metal hurtling through the air, even if you listen closely enough, a certain hum. That was negotiable? I might have said 30 feet, eh? Too focused, I imagine, upon the part where everyone gets to stay alive. At dawn, they go trooping out, the lot of them, to a quoiting ground near the water. When there's just light enough to see the other meg by, the contest begins. After each disputant wins a game, and they agree not to play the third, receiving each a kiss of equal vivacity from the fair pretext herself, all repair to breakfast amid smoky and sodden good companionship. Returning north, mud tracks, black wet branching of trees overhead as revelations of earth out through the snow, Dixon, inhabiting silence, waits, clop after clop, mile after mile, for some kind of sense to be made of what has otherwise been a pointless trip. Somewhere between Joppa and Head of Elk, lightless within and without, he begins to whistle, and presently to sing. Whole cat in the parlor, hound dog up the tree. Continental ladies are riddle enough for me. In all Virginia, though slaves passed before his sight, he saw none. That was what had not occurred. It was all about something else, not Calverts, Jesuits, Penns, nor Chinese. Chapter 40. Having marked the 6th anniversary of Rebecca's passing, Mason leaves the Forks of Brandywine and proceeds north, arriving in New York by way of the Staten Island Ferry. The approaching skyline negligible but for a great steeple far to port belonging to the Trinity Church at the head of Wall Street, where he will attend services on Sunday. But then there is Monday night. The Battery's the spot to be, he is informed by all he meets who know the town. It proves to be a testimonial to desire, for upon a cold night of wind that tears the flames from the torches and sends waves against the sea wall, yet along that lee shore, amorous gates, more cautious for the wet footing, go well into the midnight a parade of needful citizens, faces ever bent from the assault of wind smooth as light, towards the empty path, the unapproachable shadow, acts never specified. Mason, seeing no point, joins them for a while nonetheless. It all proceeds wordless as a skating party. Presently he has fallen in with a certain Amelia, a milkmaid of Brooklyn, somehow alone in New York without funds. Here, then, you've not eaten. He is correct. At a tavern in Pearl Street, she scoffs down several chops, a platter of roasted potatoes, her bowl of fish chowder and his, before Mason has buttered his bread. A clock strikes the hour. Oh, no, they must run to catch the last ferry back to her farm upon Long Island. A bittersweet passage, ferries everywhere upon that cold and cloud-torn Styx, bells dolefully a-clang in the murk, strange little gaff-rigged coasters and lighters veering all over the water, stacked high above decks with cargo. A prosperous hell. Amy is dressed from boots to bonnet, all in different articles of black. A curious choice of color for a milkmaid, it seems to Mason, though, as he has been instructed ever to remind himself, this is New York, where other customs prevail. Oh, I at home there on me about it without mercy, she tells him. But I like black. Yet my uncle, he's as strangers will take you for I don't know what. Hey, I don't know what either, do you? How should I? You're a stranger, aren't you? Well, what would you take me for? Days later, riding back to Brandywine through the Jerseys, he will rehearse endlessly whether she said, would you take me or do you take me, and ways he might have improved upon, his actual reply. She does glance back with an expression he's noted often in his life from women, though never sure what it means. The uncle seems young for one of that designation, his hair ashine with some scented pomade, side whiskers shaved to quite acute angles, his hand ever straying to consult the oversized and far from ornamental dirk he wears in a scabbard upon his belt. With Mason he is genial but guarded. Toward Amy, however, even Mason detects insinuations of reprisal to come. All her funds, even the pennies little Ezekiel gave her to buy him sweets? Oh, Amelia, dear, oh, dear. Was she careless? Was that it? Did she look in the window of some English shop and see a frock she fancied? Did one of those awful big city dips fly by and lift her whole bundle, perhaps as an exercise? Is that what happened, Amelia? Pronouncing the name with such vexation that Mason faces the inconvenient dilemma of stepping in as a gentleman must, yet on behalf of someone he has crossed a river with under, it now appears, an assumed name. Where is his loyalty presumed to lie? It isn't as if they have been at all, as you'd say, intimate, is it? Fortunately, by this point in his deliberations, Amelia, in a suggestive tone, is murmuring, I know I've been ever so wicked, Uncle, but the gentleman has been very kind. Causing a redirection of the avuncular gaze upon Mason, for reasons he will grasp only later, when Dixon explains it to him back in camp, with gestures, some of them impatient. We all appreciate a kind gentleman round here, the young man offers, as into the parlor behind him now slide an assortment of rogues, weirder than any mason has yet seen, be it at Portsmouth, or the Cape, or even Lancaster Town. Look what pussy's brought in, leers a half-breed with a braided queue. Brit, by the look of him, cries a short, freckled seaman, in whom stature and pugnacity enjoy an inverse relation. Long way from home, ain't you, old gloak? Who does your wigs, cuz? There, there, my lads, think of the impression we must be making, when we ought to be showing our guest that here in Brooklyn we can be just as warm and friendly as they are over in New York. We're not country folk, after all. We've seen them all manner of traveler, saints and sinners, green and seasoned, some who could teach eels to wriggle, and some who were pure fiduciary edge. And I'll tell you this one, I don't know. What do you think, Patsy? He's not so easy to read. You've done the ferry boat lurk. You know all the kiddies. What say you? Someone who in different costume might easily be taken for a pirate of the century past gives Mason the up and down. New one on me, Captain. The differently sized eyeballs suggest a life spent peering into small openings. Yet he's not a bum bailiff, nor a bum's assistant. Lacks that what you would call cool disinterest. Amen to that, cries the lewd half-breed. Where would his interests lie, do you think? Inquires Uncle. Everyone looks at Amelia. Excuse me, I'm supposed to know? I'm sure I was as ahoy sailor and stuff, she exclaims at last. What's he been peeping into, then? The truculent sailor yells. General again is the merriment. I observe the heavens, Mason seeking through the force of his upward gaze some self-elevation. I am a cadastral surveyor, upon a contractual assignment, in a tone inviting a respectful hush. Instead of which, Amelia, squealing in alarm, Cad? Ass? Ooh! Jumps backward into the not entirely unwelcoming embrace of her uncle, whilst a number of dogs begin to wail, as it seems, disappointedly, and a thick-set Irishman, announcing in a pleasant voice, I'll kill him, if you lot would rather not, begins to load his pistol. There, there, black powder, now put it away. Sir, the lad's confused, hates the English king and all his subjects as well. Best to tell him you're French, use an accent if you can manage it. No, killing him is out of the question, Blackie, for you see, he's the renowned astronomer, Monsieur Maisong. Nor am I here to gather the intelligence, as Blackie's eyes narrow thoughtfully, on behalf of anyone, for pity's sake, were it not for your niece. Ah, pray ye, Captain, I am well into my 37th year. My point, exactly. You see how she is, a dewdrop trembling upon the morn of womanly awakening, not yet assaulted by that day you and I well know, let alone savaged, used up, and thrown aside. Botha, she strikes me rather as a resourceful young woman, independent in her ways. Others would say willful. One day soon, someone will have to ask her to stop wearing black cloth, as it all comes here from England. Yet who among us is eager for the task? They'll hear her across the river. No black cloth? Rum little gesture to insist upon. It goes to the heart of this, snarls the half-breed, Drogo. All the Brits want us for is to buy their goods. The only use we can be to them is as a herd of animals, much like the cow, from whose udders, as from our purses, the contents may be periodically removed. Well, if all we have to withhold from them be a few pitiable coins, then so let us do, hoping others may add to the sum. May add. Mason, squinting into a neutral corner, considers this. Upon the one hand, he has heard highwaymen address travelers they wish to rob in tones less direct. Upon the other, if they are willing to call it a bribe, Mason is certainly willing to discuss the size of it. As it happens, sir, yours may be just the helping hand we need. Be you familiar with any aspect of telescopic repair? Enough not to cause too much damage. In the silence following, everyone but Mason exchanges looks. Oh, he's all right, decides Amy's uncle, whose sobriquet, for few here use Christian names, is Captain Volcano. If he reads the papers, he knows what we are. Sir, when there is light enough, would you mind having a look? The telescope stands in its own windowed observatory at the top of the house, before it the edge of the river, behind it a green plain strewn with groves and homesteads, and stems of smoke in wandering ascent, their yearnings how like our own. The instrument seems to be pointing down toward the shipyards across the river, commanding a view, in fact, of all the docking along Water Street, and more obliquely of the riverfront down to the Whitehall Slip at the south end of the island, unto Governor's Island beyond, and the Buttermilk Channel. A field marshal's dream. Here, mutters Mason, 'tis designed to be aimed upward, you see, not down for one thing. All the relevant screw adjustments on this model end effectively at the horizon. For, as with our thoughts, to aim downward is to risk squinting into the eyepiece. Something has knocked these lenses quite out of line. You need to recollimate. How long will that take to fix? You really need a Frenchman for a job like this. That is, hey, you're a Frenchman, you said. Oui, I meant. Of course, I am your man. What tools are there? Not many. The subtle and ingenious Monsieur Mason must unscrew the fastening rings with blacksmith's tongs, padded with the remains of a hat which has met with some violent misadventure, almost certainly including fire. Sheep and poultry wander in and out of his atelier. Black Powder looks in frequently, brandishing a different weapon each time. Do I make ye twitchy, sir? Capital. Feeling not quite a prisoner, Mason works through the day. From across the river come the sounds of mauls upon pegs, shipfitters' ejaculations, the squeal of lines and shivs, thuds and far-carrying cries, ship's bells, chandlers' dogs hungry all day, bumboats crying their merchandise. Members of the collectivity climb the ladder, to appearance but curious in a friendly way, and soon the room is full of young men and women in avid disputation. Someone brings up sandwiches, and someone else a bottle, and as night comes down over New York like a farmer's mulch, sprouting seeds of light, some reflected in the river, the company, Mason working on in its midst, becomes much exercised upon the topic of representation. No taxation. Without it, yes, yes, but Drogo lad, can you not see, even through the Republican fogs which ever hang about these parts, that 'tis all a moot issue, as America has long been perfectly and entirely represented in the House of Commons through the principle of virtual representation? Cries of, ah, and that again. If this be part of Britain here, then so must be Bengal. For we have taken both from the French. We purchased India many times over with the night of the black hole alone, as we have purchased North America with the lives of our own. Are even village idiots taken in any more by that empty cant, mutters the tiny top man, McNoise, no more virtual than virtuous, and no more virtuous than the vilest of that narrow room full of shoving, beef-faced louts to which you refer. Their honor bought and sold so many times over that no one bothers more to keep count. Suggest you, sir, even in play, that this giggling rout of poxy half-wits embody us? Embody us? America but some fairy emanation without substance that hath passed by miracle into them? Damme, I think not. Hell were a better destiny. Why, exclaims the captain, 'tis the doctrine of transubstantiation which bears to the principle you speak of a curious likeness. That's, of course, considering members of Parliament, like the bread and wine of the Eucharist, to contain, in place of the Spirit of Christ, the will of the people. Then those who gather in Parliaments and Congresses are no better than ghosts? Or no worse, Mason cannot resist putting in, if we proceed, that is, to consubstantiation, or the bread and wine remaining bread and wine, whilst the spiritual presence is revealed in parallel fashion, so to speak. Closer to the Parliament we are familiar with here on earth, as whatever they may represent, yet do they remain dismayingly humans as well. Everyone stops eating and drinking to stare at him. Parlez-vous? Inquires Blackie. Hey? All respect, sir. 'Tis not near as fussy as that. We dressed content with someone in Parliament along the lines of Mr. Franklin recently in London, someone that side of the herring, looking out for the interests of the province. Walking into that Board of Trade. Right, then, here I am in person, turning on that damned charm. I, an agent for parliamentary business, working for us, not some symbol of the people who won't care a rat's whisker about his borough, who will indeed sell out his voters for a chance to grovel his way to even a penny's worth more advantage in the world of global meddling he imagines as reality. Yet representation must extend beyond simple agentry, protests Patsy, unto at least Mr. Garrick, who in representing a role becomes the character as by some transfer of soul. You want someone to go to London and pretend to be an American who hates stamped paper, something like that? Send over actor envoys, stroller plenipotentiaries? Appalling. Not that bad a thought, and consider preachers as well. Mr. Garrick said to envy Whitefield's knack for bringing a congregation to tears simply by pronouncing Mesopotamia. If we'd but had someone there, why, there might be no miserable stamp tax now. And till we have someone that can prevent the next such, why, the Stamp Act is simple tyranny, and our duty is to resist it. Mason expects shocked murmurs at this. That there are none shocks him even more gravely, allowing him a brief, careening glimpse at how far and fast all this may be moving. Something styling itself, America, coming into being, ripening like a tree full of cherries in a good summer, almost as one stands and watches, something no one in London, however placed in the web of privilege, however up to the minute, seems to know much about. What is happening? Even playing cards, they want to take a shilling the pack. If your Parliament go ahead with this, we'll have a summer like the world has never seen. Not my Parliament, Mason alertly. Do I take it, then, that you own no property wherever it is you're from, sir? What rooms in my adult life have not been rented to me, Mason reckons, have been included among the terms of my employment. Then you're a serf, as they call it here, a slave. Sir, I work under contract. Someone owns you, sir. He pays for your meals and lodging. He lends you out to others. What is that called, where you come from? Why, and if you are free of such arrangements, Mason shrugs, hurrah thrice over, and perhaps one day you may instruct all the rest of us in how, exactly. So we shall, the tone balanced upon a blade's edge between pity and contempt. Mason, not wishing to look into his eyes, carefully scrapes the blacking from around a set screw, then with the worn tip of a hunting knife removes it, a quarter turn at a time. I have had this promise in Philadelphia as well, from coffee house cabals and such. We are in correspondence, says the captain, as are all the provinces, one with another. You may wish to pass that on to London. This is continental. What's happening? Amelia, attached to an avuncular sleeve, is gazing at Mason with new interest. Didn't know you were famous, she murmurs, working directly for the king, the captain says. Well, I'm as amazed. Alas, no longer, out in the woods these days, running lines for a couple of lords in a squabble. An exercise in futility. I can't believe you, Cuffins. In a few seasons hence, all your work must be left to grow over, never to be redrawn, for in the world that is to come, all boundaries shall be erased. You believe Christ's return to be imminent? Mason, feigning heartiness. That is surely wonderful news, brother. In my own faith, we believe the same, except possibly for the imminent part. Is this worth explaining to him? Drogo asks the captain. Degrees of slavery, sir? Where in England are you from? A mask-dropping sigh. Stroud, God help me. Then you have known it. I have encountered slavery both at the Cape of Good Hope and in America, and to shallow sophistry to compare it with the condition of a British weaver. You've had the pleasure of dragoons in your neighborhood? They prefer rifle butts to whips. The two hurt differently. What otherwise is the difference in the two forms of regulation? Masters presume themselves better than any who, at their bidding, must contend with the real forces and distances of the world, no matter how good the pay. When weavers try to remedy the inequality by forming associations, the clothiers bring in infantry to kill, disable, or deliver up to transportation any who be troublesome. These being then easily replaced, and even more cheaply, by others quite happy to labor in silence. Yet slaves are not paid, whereas weavers... Being from Stroud, sir, I think you know how weavers are paid. Though Wolfe preferred to settle the pay list with lead and steel, keeping his hand in between glorious victories, thinking he'd use weavers for target practice. Nasty little man. Hated Americans, by the way. Contemptible, cowardly dogs who fall down dead in their own shit, I believe was the way he phrased it. Mason recalls well enough that autumn of 56 when the celebrated future martyr of Quebec, with six companies of infantry, occupied that unhappy town after wages were all cut in half and the master weavers began to fiddle the chains on the bar, and a weaver was lucky to earn tuppence for 8 hours' work. Mason, in those same weeks, was preparing to leave the Golden Valley, to begin his job as Bradley's assistant, even as soldiers were beating citizens and slaughtering sheep for their pleasure, fouling and making six streams once holy. His father, meantime, cursing his son for a coward, as loaves by the dozens were taken with no payment but a sergeant's smirk. Mason, seeing the choices, had chosen Bradley and Bradley's world when he should instead have stood by his father and their small doomed paradise. "Who are they," inquires the Reverend in his day book, "that will send violent young troops against their own people? Their mouths ever keeping up the same weary rattle about freedom, toleration, and the rest, whilst their own land is as occupied as ever it was by Rome. These forces look like Englishmen. They were born in England. They speak the language of the people flawlessly. They cheerfully eat jellied eels, joints of mutton, treacle tarts, all that vile, unwholesome diet which maketh the involuntary American more than once bless his exile. Yet their intercourse with the mass of the people is as cold with suspicion and contempt as that of any foreign invader. We shall all of us learn who they are," Captain V, with a melancholy fizz, "and all too soon." Wednesday morning, Mason waves goodbye at the dock, where they've all come down to the ferry, and Patsy boards with him to see him across and past the inconveniences of New York. Arrived at last in the Jerseys, Patsy claps him on the shoulder. "We could be at war in another year. What a thought, eh?" I do not enjoy regular luncheon engagements with these people, but I am close enough to tell you this. They will not admit to error. They rely upon colorful madmen and hired bullies to get them through the perilous places, and they blunder on. Beware them. "Thank you, sir. It must have cost you at least a few years of believing otherwise, and I appreciate it. We all do." Coming back down through the Jerseys, Mason and his horse abruptly disjoin. "Met some boys," says the field book entry for Sunday, the 24th, "just come out of a Quaker meeting house as if the devil had been with them. I could by no means get my horse by them. I gave the horse a light blow on the head with my whip, which brought him to the ground as if shot dead.